Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
My word still made it to Broadway. I don't care if no one else knew about it. You know, it's a great thing, and I should be proud.
That's journalist Malcolm Gladwell. He'll tell us about how his work made it to Broadway, without him really trying or even knowing about it. But was that plagiarism? This hour, we'll examine just what is and isn't plagiarism. Also, music sampling and its relationship to plagiarism.
The soundbite, this fragment, the ad, you know, all of these kinds of advertising that we see these days, it's eerily about the micro niche. People just respond to small snippets, and sampling is on the vanguard of that.
And Judge Richard Posner on the Little Book of Plagiarism. But first, Jonathan Lethem. He's the author of 7 novels. He was named one of the 2005 recipients of the MacArthur Fellowship, which is often referred to as the Genius Grant. Lethem's also the author of a very provocative essay in Harper's Magazine called The Ecstasy of Influence, a Plagiarism. And as the subtitle indicates, Jonathan Lethem appropriated the words of many authors to cover the subject of plagiarism, although he provides full attribution of his sources at the end of the essay.
The first thing, of course, to say about that idea of a composite text made up of other people's writings is it's not an original idea. I stole that too because it's been done before. But, you know, I think that this essay became an opportunity for me to make plain what I feel is an intrinsic aspect of writing, or at least of my writing, which is that it's nourished everywhere by my reading, and that in a sense – to create a text is to browse in one's own library, whether it's a literal process or a kind of, you know, a mental reconstruction of one's own sources and influences and the voices in one's head. So this was an essay that seemed to demand that I confess this, that I say, you know, a lot of the most interesting things I say, I could, you know, run you back to my shelves and say, well, that's sort of from this book, and this stuff comes from over here, and, you know, everything I do is, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants.
Well, I mean, it does kind of add an element of the surreal to it, because what we're going to talk about over the next few minutes is your writing, but it's not necessarily going to be your writing, or only a little bit of it is your writing. I mean, writing this essay, you knew. You did this on purpose. You very determinedly used elements that you were aware came from other sources. But I wonder, other times, is it possible to be aware of the sources of all your creative energy?
I doubt it. I certainly feel that I'm one of the more consciously, or maybe I should say comfortably, influenced writers I know. I'm always putting something on the page and thinking, oh, that's sort of like, you know, that scene in Hitchcock. Yeah, I must be deriving some energy from that scene, or this is a little bit like a Don DeLillo sentence. Well, no surprise, I love Don DeLillo. But of course, other influences creep in constantly that are only spotted in retrospect or that some reader points out to me. So I don't think you could ever be completely conscious of every choice you make that has that kind of operation underneath it. And anyway, I suspect that every choice has that operation underneath it at some level. One of the reasons that I'm so confident of this in a way is having written this essay and entered into conversations about it, I sometimes forget which sentences in this one are mine and which come from elsewhere. And I have to go back and check.
Actually, it's the checking that is kind of intellectually stimulating, isn't it? It forces you to go through all of those things that you've learned from. And you're not alone in this, as you point out at one point. Well, you were talking about Bob Dylan, for instance. I think you used the word appropriation for him, but you say it's always played a role in his music. And why not?
Well, I think, you know, he's one of the most fascinating artists for contemplating this paradox. I mean, there's no one who seems more absolutely singular and original. He demands to be looked at as a kind of, you know, he changes the history of his art form, the way Picasso or Shakespeare or whomever changes theirs. And yet almost everything in his work has been claimed as a theft at some point.
Certainly. Give me an example. Maybe just.
Well, it begins for him with Blowing in the Wind, which, you know, in an episode that was quite unpleasant at the time, I think it was Newsweek magazine that sort of busted him or, you know, mentioned some other melody that had been appropriated. And there are still people who don't know much about Bob Dylan who will tell you, well, I've heard that he stole Blowing in the Wind. And right up to the present day where the New York Times art section ran a kind of gotcha piece where they pointed out the strong similarity, the unmistakable appropriation of some lyrics by the Civil War poet Henry Timrod in his newest record. And in fact, many people see the previous record, Love and Theft, which takes its title from someone's book, as a kind of open discussion, in a sense, of those issues in his work. The fact that it's sourced at every level from other places.
Well, I mean, the question that it raises, of course, is the difference, if there is any, between appropriation, using someone else's ideas to stimulate your own creativity, and plagiarism, which is outright theft.
Well, you know, the game I sort of tried to play with this essay was to treat the word plagiarism as if it was value neutral, as if you could, instead of always cringing and feeling that it was a word of attack, that you might say, well, sure, okay, plagiarism. Was it good plagiarism or bad plagiarism? Bad plagiarism would be that which is uninspired. When something is lifted and, well, the first thing that's uninspired about it is that nothing has been added that's interesting. It's not been recontextualized or combined with anything else or made fresh or unexpected. It's just simply presented again. And the second deplorable aspect is the most basic deception, is it's presented without any attribution or without any even hint, without any suggestion that it might come from somewhere else. Well, that's obvious. Everyone hates that kind of plagiarism. It's easy to dislike. But it seems to me that the dislike for the bad kind has leaked over into a misunderstanding about what artists almost always do at least a little bit of, which is gather sources together and transform them. And that everything, well, Mary Shelley, who I plagiarized in my piece, her sentence that I loved so much was, "Art comes not out of the void, but out of chaos." In other words, we're surrounded by influences. We can't help but participate in the conversation of culture. Artworks and, for that matter, newspapers and conversation, images, commercials, everything swirls around us. And of course, when we sit down to write or make a painting or make a song, we're going to be responding, we're going to be converting and transforming this kind of material, because the question is, how could we ever do anything else?
Yeah. So you think there isn't any question in your mind that there is something called intellectual property that relates to culture, but it isn't
there? I don't like the term. I think it invites a misunderstanding that is all too easily exploited in the principle of private ownership of culture. And that is to suggest that a thought or even a piece of language, intellectual property, can be property in the same sense that a wallet is a wallet, and if you steal my wallet, I haven't got it anymore. Well, if you steal my sentence, it's not exactly gone. Something has happened, and it's potentially interesting, it's potentially objectionable, it's potentially wonderful what happens to it after that, but it's not been taken from my possession.
I wonder if you'd mind reading the last paragraph of your essay for us.
Sure. Here goes. As a novelist, I'm a cork on the ocean of story, a leaf on a windy day. Pretty soon I'll be blown away. For the moment, I'm grateful to be making a living, and so must ask that for a limited time, in the Thomas Jefferson sense, you please respect my small, treasured use monopolies. Don't pirate my additions. Do plunder my visions. The name of the game is give all. You, reader, are welcome to my stories. They were never mine in the first place, but I gave them to you. If you have the inclination to pick them up, take them with my blessing.
It's very nice.
Before we pass along, we should say that the very niceness that you're praising is only partly mine. The elegance of those lines, those concluding lines of the essays, is almost entirely creditable to Saul Bellow, who wrote those lines in a letter to a friend who had at the time accused him of stealing the facts of his life and putting them into a novel.
So thinking about this Harper's essay, you used a lot of people's ideas, a lot of people's art in order to do that. Was it hard?
It was – so glad you asked. I mean, you know, the first thing you think when you think about plagiarism is, oh, someone's saving themselves some effort. Well, maybe there are forms like downloading a, you know, a dissertation on the internet and putting your name at the top of it and giving it to your graduate advisor. But boy, this was the most work I've ever had in my life. You know, finding all of these sources, all of these people so much smarter than I was, and figuring out what part of their language, what part of their thinking I could usefully adopt as my own, and then having to jigger it all together and write the interstitial sentences that would make it seem that it, you know, flowed from the words of David Foster Wallace into the words of Lawrence Lessig.
Can you just lay it out for us?
Well, sure. This paragraph goes, I believe, if I'm remembering it all correctly, from Roland Barthes to Mark Twain to Ralph Waldo Emerson to Lethem. I finish it up. And within those seven sentences, you're getting all four authors. Do you mind to read it to you?
Yes, please.
Any text is woven entirely with citations, references, echoes, cultural languages, which cut across it through and through in a vast stereophony. The citations that go to make up a text are anonymous, untraceable, and yet already read. They are quotations without inverted commas. The kernel, the soul, let us go further and say the substance, the bulk, the actual and valuable material of all human utterances is plagiarism. Okay, so the first part of that was Barthes, but when I started saying the kernel, that switched to Mark Twain. I'll continue with Twain. For substantially, all ideas are secondhand, consciously and unconsciously drawn from a million outside sources and daily used by the garnerer with a pride and satisfaction born of the superstition that he originated them, whereas there is not a rag of originality about them anywhere except the little discoloration they get from his mental and moral caliber and his temperament, and which is revealed in characteristics of phrasing. Old and new make the warp and woof of every moment. There is no thread that is not a twist of these two strands. When I switched to old and new, I was switching to Ralph Waldo Emerson. I'll continue with Emerson. By necessity, by proclivity, and by delight, we all quote. Neurological study has lately shown that memory, imagination, and consciousness itself is stitched, quilted, pastiched. If we cut and paste ourselves, might we not forgive it of our artworks? When I switched from we all quote to neurological study, I was switching from Emerson to myself. So that was seven sentences, and it was Barthes, Twain, Emerson, Lethem.
Jonathan Lethem. He's a novelist and the author of The Ecstasy of Influence, a Plagiarism, an essay published in Harper's Magazine. You may have heard about the British pianist Joyce Hatto. She died in June at the age of 77, but her music lives on. However, it now turns out that not all of the music attributed to Hatto was hers. Hatto's widower has admitted to passing off recordings by other pianists as those of his wife. He says he was trying to get her the recognition that her poor health had prevented her from receiving. Recording of Franz Liszt's Mazeppa, attributed to Joyce Hatto, apparently performed by Laszlo Simon. Paul Paul D. Miller is better known as DJ Spooky, that subliminal kid, an electronic and experimental hip-hop musician. He's a turntablist and producer. He's also the author of a book called Rhythm Science. In the book, DJ Spooky writes about how he creates audio art, much of which involves sampling, taking existing pieces of sound and transforming them into new works. DJ Spooky talked to Ann Strainchamps about rhythm science and the fine art of sampling.
It speaks to multiple cultural spaces, you know, like sort of simultaneously. And sampling and editing and the way people really put together digital culture these days is every part of even what I'm saying now will probably be edited in some way, shape, or form. So you eventually get to the point where you realize editing itself is the inheritor of collage. You know, you can see a century of Pablo Picasso. You can see a century of early Marcel Duchamp. You can see a century of French poets like Apollinaire or Mallarmé doing their symbolist cut-up poetry. Radio, TV, satellite broadcasts, everything is edits. The software that we use to edit is just as much a part of the artwork, you know? So it's connected. I think of sampling as saying, look, all right, we have this incredibly dense media landscape that we, you know, as human beings have made and we've moved into. It's not really outside of us anymore, or it probably never was. So writing is kind of old school, you know, it's really two-dimensional. And sampling is like, well, let's unpack what we think of as a text and say that this is a memory and this is a game we're going to play, and that makes things fun. Sampling is saying, look, we're with the information overload and you want to tailor things till they make sense for you. The 20th century was mass culture, mass standardization. The 21st is about mass customization, making everything fit to your specific taste and needs.
So are you also saying that this idea of originality, which has been such a key idea in art, is sort of outmoded?
Not necessarily. I just think the idea of originality is, and the intense hunger the West has for the new is kind of overrated, because the new is always an extension of the old, and the old is always an extension of something else that came before. One of my favorite poets and writers, Ralph Waldo Emerson, has a great essay in the mid-19th century called Of Quotation and Originality. You know, and he was talking about this whole American ideal of the new, and it was just a really great essay. I'm a big fan of Emerson and the early American transcendentalist movement, you know, Walt Whitman and Thoreau and all these guys.
Mm. In your book, Rhythm Science, there's a quotation from that Emerson essay, something like, it's as difficult to appropriate the thoughts of others as it is to invent.
Yeah, yeah. Emerson really got the idea of why I think America is the culture of quotation, because the soundbite, this fragment, the ad, you know, all of these kinds of advertising that we see these days, whether it's cell phone banners or website text banners, you know, it's just, it's eerily about the micro niche, you know, like people just respond to small snippets. And sampling is on the vanguard of that, whether it's Quentin Tarantino's films where he takes all these scenes from Asian cinema but then redoes them. Some of the biggest films in the last couple of years, there's one called The Ring. It's set in a Japanese culture, but the remake of it was kind of funny because it was set in L.A. or something. Newness in the West, if you look at what's going on with Japanese, or if you look at what's going on with Chinese or India, Bollywood film, I mean, they say, like, what is new? Nothing's new. What are you talking about? But for us, you know, we're living in the era of the franchise, the sequel, and those are still, you know, Star Wars is the parable of it all, really. You know, you have this nonlinear film where George Lucas releases version 11 and then number 3. And you know, it's all come home to roost. That's all. Your average kid now is just thinking life is a big video game or something.
So let's talk about a few specific examples of your music. There's a CD that comes with your book, Rhythm Science, and one track includes a reading from James Joyce. He's reading from Finnegan's Wake.
Well, you know, Dr. Kenneth, or haven't I told you, every telling is a tailing, and that's the he and the she of it. Look, look, the dusk is growing. My branches lofty are taking root, and my cold chair's gone ashy.
Will you tell me something about the process you went through in making that piece?
Yeah, Rhythm Science, my book was kind of focused on how do you get people to think of sampling and digital media and this kind of collage-based style of writing as an inheritor of all these early avant-garde movements. So what's funny about writing a book and then having the CD is that the pun there is you're looking at Marshall McLuhan, you know, you're looking at the medium is the massage. That was one of his kind of clever word plays. And I consider DJing and sampling as pure McLuhan-esque. And the way that he dealt with media hot and cool, the idea of mechanical brides, the uncanny. So my book really is a homage to that, but also looking at sound and memory. So say, for example, the records that I included, I had Tristan Tzara's Dada Manifestos, Marcel Duchamp's lectures on creativity, Gertrude Stein's poetry, a Cubist portrait of Picasso.
If I told him a completed portrait of Picasso, if I told him, would he like it? Would he like it if I told him? Would he like it? Would he told him?
All these kinds of heroes of the Academy, for them to get mixed with stuff like Wu-Tang Clan or... The mashup is like, I like to think of my book as the academic equivalent of what Danger Mouse did with the Grey album, where he took the Beatles' White album and mixed it with Jay-Z's The Black album. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a very funny album, the Danger Mouse. But my book was saying, okay, this is a different kind of literacy, and you're going to prioritize how you relate to high versus low. You know, is remixing James Joyce art, or is it just some kid in the studio messing around? It's the same thing with Duchamp putting a sink urinal on the wall. There's a kind of a tricksterism going on here.
So you're saying that this partly this combination of sort of conceptual high art with popular culture goes way back?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if there's one thing that you look at throughout the 20th century, all the artists were tricksters. They were playing with perception. You had the Cubist movement where they broke down human form. You had all the kinds of literary tropes that the Dada guys would cut up words and scramble them and use different fonts to make their manifestos. So you had the Italian futurist, my particular favorite. Luigi Russolo had this great manifesto where he has this book called The Art of Noise, which is a classic 1913, 1915. You know, it's a pretty intense book where he's like, the city itself is my compositional tool, originality, forget it, we need to blow up the museums and like try to bring in noise generators, and he had, you know, these loudspeakers on stage, and there would be riots. People would say, where's the orchestra? And he's like, I've quoted the orchestra out of existence. You're just hearing, you know, it's wild stuff. So I love playing with that. But the whole 20th century, like Warhol's, you know, kind of pun about culture of copies, where he would just do the same soup can, or Jeff Koons in the 80s, where he had statues made of himself, you know, like as copies as well.
Ask you about one of your newest projects, DJ Spooky's Rebirth of a Nation. Will you tell me something about that project?
Okay, that's my first film. I'm editing it as we speak. For the last year and a half, I've been touring it live as a big concert kind of thing. In fact, one of the wildest shows is we got the Greek government to let us play the film at the Acropolis, the Herodicus Theater.
Wow.
I'm like, why does he want to project a Ku Klux Klan film at the Acropolis? But yeah, the whole idea is comedy and tragedy, you know, the theater of the absurd. And looking back to 1915, Griffiths, of course, he's one of America's premier filmmakers, but he's kind of the DNA of American cinema. You know, he invented the close-up. He invented the idea of multiple stories going on. So my remix of it was to take that kind of editing technique and apply DJ technique to it and say this is a collision between what he's doing with the editing technique and looking at structure, you know, how he really was a brilliant manipulator of emotion. In fact, if you look at a lot of the early propaganda films of the era, like Sergei Eisenstein or Leni Riefenstahl, they all quote him. Or even later people like Francis Ford Coppola. There's a famous scene in Apocalypse Now where the helicopters are flying in over the horizon to strafe this village and they start playing Wagner.
But Birth of a Nation was, it's kind of like a KKK recruitment film. It's one of the most racist films ever made.
Oh, sure.
So what made you want to pick that one?
There's two issues at hand. One, I want to assure all the audience out there, I'm not a Klan member. As an African-American, my mom asked me this. She was like, Paul, don't you know this film is totally racist? I was like, yes. And the point being is that it lets decode some of the issues here. You have an occupied nation. You have people in blackface. You have a political environment of corruption. You have a film that shows the first flawed election. You know, there's a scene where the whites are turned away by black voters, which is kind of ironic if you look at the last couple of elections in the U.S. So I view the film as quite current, not necessarily about just pounding you over the head with race issues, but looking at political, economic, and above all, the use of propaganda to create a war environment.
What do you do with the film? I mean, in your remix, what do people see when they come to see it?
They see a triptych. There's three screens. The main screen is the remix, and the two side screens are the images of the sequence that you just saw. So it gives people an idea of the original versus the remix, and I kind of juxtapose it. For the commercial DVD, which I'm editing now, it's going to be remixable cinema. So you put the DVD in, and I'm having Kronos Quartet play the soundtrack of my compositions. There's going to be a remixable soundtrack, too.
You know, in the high art world, the world of conceptual art that you're partly playing in, sampling comes awfully close to plagiarism. So is there a line, I mean, a difference between the two, or is the whole idea of plagiarism just an outmoded idea?
Well, whenever I think of when you say the high-low, I automatically go to Marcel Duchamp's Sink Urinal, which is he took a well-known work of a utility and put it on the gallery wall. And it was controversial, like, big time. People, they're almost riots. People were really pissed off. I mean, even the term, of course, pissed off, all puns intended. And, you know, how do we think about originality? Did I make up the words I'm using and the language that we're both using? No, I'm using bits and clips, words that became popular, words that evolved. You know, so sampling and plagiarism are part of your vocabulary. Everybody quotes and everybody takes bits and pieces of well-known bits of other people's phrases. That's how you build your vocabulary. Look at DNA. DNA constantly is recycling itself. That's plagiarism. I look at it much more as a kind of environmental, ecological, like info-ecology, where, yeah, you have these networks. You have bits and pieces flying around that everybody is sort of downloading and using. And plagiarism is essentially just saying it's like cannibalism, but it's ancestor worship. You know, you might have a little soup of papa, but at the end of the day, you know, it's like playing with respect for the history of things.
Paul D. Miller, also known as DJ Spooky, that subliminal kid. He spoke with N. Strangechamps about his book Rhythm Science. DJ Spooky also has a track on Yoko Ono's new album, Yes, I'm a Witch, which features guest artists remixing and reworking Ono's music. And speaking of remixes, our technical director, Carrillo, and reworked the DJ Spooky interview to create the following DJ Spooky, to the best of our knowledge, mashup.
Oh, hey, while you're there, okay. Hey, how you doing? Every part of even what I'm saying now will probably be edited in some way, shape, or form. I'm just kind of a hologram here. Radio, TV, satellite broadcast, everything is edits. Maybe we need to look at history so that we understand info ecology. There's the infamous phrase, those who don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat it. Repeat it. Plagiarism is about vocabulary. It's about syntax. I realize sampling is playing with memory. But look at DNA. DNA constantly is recycling itself. That's plagiarism. Everything is connected. Info ecology. It's connected. Everything is connected. It's connected. Everything is connected. It's connected.
Are we making too much of plagiarism these days? You know, we'd love to know what you think. You can send us comments through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, Judge Richard Posner on the history and ethics of plagiarism. And Malcolm Gladwell tells us how the theft of his words caused him to rethink his attitude toward plagiarism. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The Honorable Richard A. Posner is a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals, 7th District. He's also a prolific author. His most recent book is called The Little Book of Plagiarism. Posner talked to Steve Paulson about, what else? Plagiarism.
Yes, it's an interesting example of behavior that's regarded as wrongful, but it hasn't been brought under a kind of legal regime. So the sanctions are informal, though they can be quite serious, but also partly because it isn't under a legal regime, it's not clearly defined. And so, you know, copyright infringement, huge body of law and so on, there are areas of uncertainty, but there's a great deal of definition. But with plagiarism, there isn't any kind of official body like a court to tell you what is plagiarism or not. And that causes a lot of problems because some people commit what they don't regard as plagiarism, but other people regard as plagiarism, and they get into trouble.
Well, it strikes me that the whole notion of plagiarism has changed a lot over the years. I mean, centuries ago, writers routinely borrowed or perhaps stole episodes from other books. I mean, Shakespeare is a famous example of someone who pilfered whole scenes. Apparently, he took the barge scene in Antony and Cleopatra directly from Plutarch's Life of Mark Antony.
Right. Yes, it's a very culturally relative term. And even today, in foreign cultures, often copying verbatim from someone else is regarded as a token of respect. And to try to do something original is regarded as presumptuous. And you're quite right. Over the centuries, it has changed considerably. Because in the olden days, there's more of a sense that creativity meant you were improving something. You weren't creating things out of the void. But today, we put much more emphasis on originality. There's one difference is, you know, something like Plutarch's Lives, it wasn't really available. It had been translated into English, but it wasn't really available to many people in England in the 16th century because a lot of illiteracy and books were very expensive and so on. So for Shakespeare to take this and revise it and then present it in plays, which, you know, a lot of people who didn't read books went to plays, he was, you know, in a funny way, he was helping to spread the word about Plutarch.
But let me ask you the other question. I mean, is it fair to call Shakespeare a plagiarist?
No, I don't think so. It's a culturally relative term. Actually, he was accused of plagiarism by a rival playwright, a fellow named Green. But generally, that was considered sour grapes. And, you know, the charge didn't stick. Because, as you said, a lot of unacknowledged copying was regarded as fair play. So, you know, it's very anachronistic to go back and say, well, Shakespeare was a plagiarist because if he were doing this today, he would be considered a plagiarist. In his culture, he was not. Although, mm-hmm. you know, he's sort of on the borderline.
But I'm wondering if this is partly a matter of, I mean, part of the interest in this story is how cultural values have changed, because there certainly is a cult of originality now. I mean, that's what people look for in a writer, for instance. And maybe it's because we live in this time where so much is mass-produced and prepackaged that we want to hear that authentic voice. And then when we hear that it's not, even though it's passed on as authentic, that's what really rubs people the wrong way.
Yes, and I think part of it is that there are financial stakes. For example, the case I discussed involving the Harvard student who had plagiarized from an established writer of chick lit novels.
This was Kavya Viswanathan.
Right. So, you know, this is a big money business. And Viswanathan had gotten a $500,000 advance for two novels. And that meant that the publisher saw her as someone who could really, you know, take a big bite out of this market. So she plagiarizes this established author, and that means the established author is going to worry that Viswanathan is going to use the established author's own words to steal sales from her. So when you have, money involved, people get very tense about this. But it's more than money, because some of these plagiarisms involve a popular writer or a prominent academic stealing from an obscure person. And that, you know, hurts the obscure person because, I mean, one thing, if the prominent person said, look, I'm repeating some things that were said by someone else years ago, and really intelligent. That person didn't get a lot of credit, so I'm going to, you know, restate his ideas, but you give him full credit and you give the obscure person a boost. But if you plagiarize, you don't acknowledge your copy, then you're sort of digging that person further into his obscurity, because you, the prominent person, get the credit for the ideas that you took from him.
Let me ask you about the case of Ian McEwan, which has gotten a lot of notoriety in recent months. And McEwan, of course, is one of the most celebrated novelists in the world. His novel Atonement was widely hailed as a masterpiece, and then it's turned out recently that a few of the scenes, particularly those set in a World War II hospital, were basically, to some degree, borrowed from a memoir that had been written years ago by an obscure writer. I mean, a woman who had written mostly romance novels, although this was from
her memoir.
Yeah, and I mean, people have lined up some of the passages, and sure enough, a few of McEwan's sentences are almost verbatim copies of what this other woman had written. And there's been a huge outcry about whether McEwan really did anything wrong.
Well, I think actually the real problem there has to do with the acknowledgments. I haven't read his book, but I did read the last page. He has a set of acknowledgments.
And he does credit her there.
And but this, I think, is the real problem, because he says in a sort of very general way, you know, I don't remember exactly how I put it, but I acknowledge having read, or, you know, having benefited from reading. And then he lists several books, of which hers is one. And when you read the acknowledgement and the list of books, the impression created is that, you know, he read some stuff and got some background information. And what he should have done, and it wouldn't have detracted from his book at all, he should have, assuming he didn't, you know, copy any words or anything from the other authors in the little list of acknowledgement, he should have said, you know, I want to give a special acknowledgement to the woman.
Her name is Lucilla Andrews.
Right, to Andrews, because I have incorporated some passages from her book, and I, you know, paraphrased them and acknowledged, you know, how much I admired those passages, because that's why I paraphrased. So if he bent over backwards to thank her, there wouldn't be any problem. People wouldn't say, oh, McEwan, he's not original, because mm-hmm. he found these passages which he thought were so good he couldn't improve on them, except, you know, maybe some minor editing. No, that's not how people think. So.
And it's worth pointing out that a lot of big-name writers came to McEwan's defense. I mean, everyone from Margaret Atwood to Thomas Pynchon, they all said, you know, stop accusing McEwan of being a plagiarist. But I think what has rubbed some people the wrong way about this whole story is, here McEwan is a world-famous writer, and he, to some degree, I mean, some people say that he essentially stole the life story, the life experience of this much less well-known writer. That's the thing that I think really rubs people the wrong way.
Yes, I don't. As I say, I haven't read his book. I haven't read her work, so I don't know the extent of it. I know I have read articles which did say that, yes, there was more than those passages. It was the idea that his central character is based on her memoir. But,
and her memoir being a nurse in World War
II.
And this whole chunk of his novel
is about
that. So he basically went to her memoir to try to recreate the atmosphere.
But I wouldn't put any weight at all in the fact that other prominent writers spring to his defense, because that's a kind of clubby thing, right? Everybody, because they don't want to be accused of this.
Now, one of the defenses that you sometimes hear from all kinds of people is that, well, you don't necessarily remember all the research that you did, and so maybe what you think is original is actually remembering something that you heard somewhere or that you read, and you're passing it off as original, but it's an honest mistake.
Well, I think that's true for ideas often, that you don't remember the origin of an idea if it's not a very important idea. And I think you could remember a phrase that you thought was, you remembered the phrase, but you didn't remember that you'd actually heard it from someone else. But what I find very hard to believe is that you could have memorized a significant passage, and although you'd memorize it, you'd forgotten that you'd memorized it. That seems to me very odd. Suppose you had a photographic memory. I don't think anybody actually has, but some people have really excellent memories, so they can remember, you know, long passages. But since they have that excellent memory, I would think they'd remember the long passage. And also, as I say, there's this matter of style that people who are at least professional writers, they have their own style. And if they suddenly found that in their something they were writing, a different style appeared, they would say, wait, this isn't me.
Richard A. Posner is a judge and the author of The Little Book of Plagiarism. He spoke from his chambers with Steve Paulson.
And now it's time for a Disney Minute. Today, a visit from Mickey Mouse.
Hi, kids. How are you? I'm fine. Bye-bye.
Mickey Mouse is a registered trademark of the Disney Corporation. Any unauthorized reproduction of his likeness in any medium is strictly prohibited. These regulations apply both to private and public use, as well as to any other use which the Disney Corporation deems unacceptable in regard to their rules and regulations concerning the infringement of copyright law. Moreover, any use of the names Mickey Mouse and or the names Mick, Michael, Mike, or Maury and or the words mouse, house, louse, or blouse will be considered an infringement of applicable copyright laws. Similarly, any person whose ears are seen to be overly round and large, i.e. exceeding an ear-to-body ratio of 1-3, shall be subject to litigation and possible criminal prosecution. Also, any person whose voice registers a frequency above 15 kilohertz is forbidden to speak unless authorized to do so under a licensing agreement with the Disney Corporation. Furthermore, the Disney Corporation forbids the wearing of white gloves, red shorts with large buttons, and don't even think about big shoes. Lastly, any mouse caught owning a pet dog shall be subject to severe penalties as provided for under the copyright laws of the United States and Canada.
That was a Disney Minute.
Bye-bye!
That's the Canadian sketch comedy trio, The Vestibules. If you have questions or comments about the program, or you just want to plagiarize someone else's, you know, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll conclude our Hour on Plagiarism with journalist Malcolm Gladwell. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Malcolm Gladwell has been a staff writer with the New Yorker magazine since 1996. He was named one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people in 2005. Gladwell is also the author of the best-selling books The Tipping Point and Blink. Malcolm Gladwell has even had his work produced on Broadway, although it happened without his knowledge and without his permission, as he told Steve Paulson.
There was a play written by an English playwright, Byron E. Laverley, that ran in England, won all kinds of prizes, and came to Broadway. It was about a psychiatrist who studies serial killers, who comes across a serial killer who years ago had killed a young girl. And the play is about the intersection between the serial killer, the psychiatrist, and the mother of that young girl who wants to meet the man who killed her child. I had written a long profile for The New Yorker about a woman named Dorothy Lewis, who is a psychiatrist who studies serial killers. Well, someone, friends of Dorothy Lewis's, went to see this play when it was on Broadway, saw it, and thought that it seemed really familiar in a certain sense. So they called up Dorothy, and Dorothy went to see the play and was like, oh my goodness, that's me in the play. And sure enough, the author of the play, Byron E. Laverley, when she was writing it, had lifted several hundred words from my article.
And some of these were direct quotes,
right? They were almost all verbatim. Some of them was passages I'd written, and some of them were she put into the mouth of the psychiatrist in the play words that Dorothy Lewis, the real psychiatrist, had actually said. Dorothy Lewis got very, very upset and hired a lawyer and wanted me to get involved in this lawsuit. And so came to me and said, look, you've been plagiarized. I would like to file a lawsuit against this woman. Would you join in this effort.
And my impression was she didn't feel like it was just a matter of plagiarism. She felt like something fundamental about herself had been stolen.
Yes, she was profoundly, profoundly upset. For her, it went beyond a simple case of words being, or her life being kind of, she felt that she had, like she said, she felt, yes, the exact phrase she used is, I feel like my life has been stolen, I want it back.
So here she comes to you and wants you to write a friendly letter on behalf of her lawsuit.
More than that, she wanted me to actually sign over the rights to my article to her, which would give her legal standing to file a lawsuit. And initially, I was like, yeah, sure. This is outrageous. You know, someone shouldn't lift my words. And then the more that I thought about it, I went and I talked to Dorothy Lewis. I talked to the lawyer involved, and then I talked to the playwright, and then I read the play. I decided, you know what? I don't think this is wrong. And I came to a very different understanding about the kind of ethics involved in this case, to the point where I now think that I have no right to be party to a lawsuit. And I don't think that what the playwright did is in any way wrong.
Why not? Even if she pulled quotes directly from your article.
There's a couple of reasons. There's two that really come to mind. The first one is, it matters what you take, right? And what she took was stuff that was pretty boilerplate. She took, you know, for example, there's a paragraph that appears in my story that also appears in the play, which is just a description of how a psychiatrist does a physical exam on a serial killer. There's another kind of boilerplate description that talks about certain kinds of neurological functions. These paragraphs were not acts of extraordinary creativity on my part. I got them from somewhere, right? So she's just taking relatively boilerplate things that I used and putting them in the mouth of someone in the play. Is that a big deal? Is that the same as stealing, you know, a chapter from my autobiography? No. There's clearly a difference, in other words, between words that are of extraordinary personal importance to you and just kind of standard stuff. That's one. Another argument, another point, important point is it matters what you do with it, right? She wasn't taking stuff from my article about my profile of a psychiatrist to write a profile of a psychiatrist. She was taking little, tiny little bits and pieces from my play to construct a wholly new work of art, something entirely new. The crux of this play is about what would happen if the mother of a child that had been murdered by a serial killer met the serial killer. And the whole play leads up to this showdown. And the showdown between the mother and the serial killer is one of the most powerful and moving passages I've ever read in a play. And when I read that, you know, first of all, it was extraordinarily moving. You can't help but cry. And secondly, and I thought to myself, here was someone who took a little piece of my work and used it to create a new and utterly magnificent work of art, right? Who am I to stand in the way of that? What right do I have to say, no, you can't do that, right? That's why, as a writer, you create things, precisely because you want someone to take what you've done and be inspired to do something wholly new. It is the height of kind of churlishness and immaturity for me to stamp my foot and say, you took 365 words from me verbatim. I don't care what you did with them. That's wrong. No, I wrote something. It was published in The New Yorker. I got paid for it. I put it on my website for anyone who wants to read it to read it. You know, by what bizarre stretch of imagination do I claim that I own these words in perpetuity? You know, that's sort of the third thing about it.
But you're in the minority among a lot of writers, I think, about this. I mean, a lot of writers see what they write is, I mean, that's their bread and butter. That's their livelihood. That's sort of the essence of who they are professionally. And, you know, don't you go and steal any of my words.
But you get, I mean, there's another point here that's really critical, and that is embedded in our idea about intellectual property in this country and throughout the West is the notion that there are limits on how long you own an idea. If you and I formed a company tomorrow, you know, Steve and Malcolm Pharmaceuticals, and we invented a cure for cancer, for all cancer, right? The biggest drug in the history of drugs, we would own that idea, even though if you and I came up with everything we did ourselves in the basement, right? We would own that idea for 17 years, at which point it would be gone, be taken away from us. The patent would expire, and there is nothing, nothing we could do to retain exclusive rights to that, even though we dreamt that up ourselves, right? We hold as a society, these words, in fact, are in the Constitution of the United States. The notion that we should put limits on people's right to intellectual property. Why? Because we have to balance private rights and public rights. The only way that knowledge can move forward and that there can be creative progress in a society is if ideas eventually enter the public realm and are available for free use by all of us. So for me as a writer to say that I have permanent ownership of my ideas runs against every notion we have about intellectual property in this country. We don't. I owned those words when I created them. And up until the point where they were published in the New Yorker and I got paid for them, they're mine, right? But I got my money on them, you know. Mm-hmm. I got my bang for the buck. I got paid. I got printed. I got plaudits. I got people calling me up and say they loved it. And that's it. I can't claim to hang on forever.
So what do you do, or what would you think about other artistic endeavors, mm-hmm. music, for instance, where, yeah. I mean, right now the standard is that a composer, if someone records a song that has been written before, the composer gets a cut of that.
Yeah. Well, I do think, I mean, this is obviously an area of intense ongoing controversy, particularly in the music industry. And my sense of trends in intellectual property is that we have become, in this balance between the public and the private, recently we've gone way too far in the private direction. And we have created this notion that, first of all, when someone comes up with a line of music, it's theirs, as if they didn't have all kinds of antecedents who influence them. And secondly, that it should be theirs in perpetuity. And I think both those notions are nonsense. I mean, music's a really good example because literally there's almost no piece of music that you can point to where you can't find something that inspired that piece of music.
And that's where a lot of great music comes from. I mean, you could say you're ripping off someone else, but you are drawing from and changing it in some way.
And that's what art is in a certain sense. It's taking what's out there and transforming it. And, you know, I don't know why we suddenly pretended that the only valid creation is creation from scratch, right? Who creates anything from scratch? Even if we came up with that breakthrough cancer drugs, we would still be, in that famous phrase of Newton's, standing on the shoulders of giants. You can only do breakthrough work in, you know, human biology if you know and understand and build on the work of 1,000 people who came before you, you know. So all of this notion that we own words in perpetuity is based on this kind of self-obsessed fiction that says that the artist stands alone. Well, the artist doesn't stand alone.
Malcolm Gladwell, star of stage, books, and magazines. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 34A, Plagiarism, Intellectual Propriety. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.